Usher, Sufis, the People of the Past, Volume 2, Talks of Sufism given at the Usher Commune International, Pune, India. Discourse number 3.
Bhagwan, Imam Muhammad Bakir is said to have related this illustrative fable. Finding I could speak the language of ants, I approached one and inquired, "What is God like? Does he resemble the ant?" He answered, "God? No, indeed. We have only a single sting, but God, he has two."
What is God? Al-Hillas Mansur says, "It is the gathering together, then the silence, then the loss of words and the awareness, then the discovery and the nakedness, and it is the fire clay, then the fire, then the clarity and the cold, then the darkness, then the sun, and it is the argy, then the casting away of cares, then the wish and the approach, then the conjunction, then the joy, and it is the strain, then the relaxation, then the disappearance and the separation, then the union, then the fusion." What is God? It depends on you. Your God will be your God. My God will be my God. There are as many gods as there are possibilities to look at God. It's natural. We cannot go beyond our plane. We can only be aware of God through our eyes, through our minds. The God will be just a reflection in our small mirror. That's why there are so many concepts about God. It is like a moon in the sky, full moon night. But there are millions of rivers and reservoirs and oceans and small streams and small puddles on the road. They all will reflect God. They all will reflect the moon. A small puddle will also reflect the moon in its own way. And the big ocean will also reflect it in its own way. Then there is great controversy. Hindus say something, Mohammedans say something else, Christians is still another, and so on and so forth. The controversy is foolish. The conflict is meaningless. God is reflected in millions of ways, in millions of mirrors. Each mirror reflects in its own way. This is one of the fundamental to be understood. Not understanding this fundamental, there is naturally antagonism between religions. Because they all think, if our standpoint is right, then the other has to be wrong. Their rightness depends on the other's wrongness. this is stupid. God is infinite. And you can look at Him through many ways, through many windows. And naturally you can look at Him only through you. You will be the window. Your God will reflect God as much as it will reflect you. You both will be there. When Mansur says something, he is saying about himself. This tremendously beautiful statement. Then the union, then the fusion, is much more about Al-Hillah's Mansur than about God. This is Mansur's God. This is Mansur's unique experience. Mansur was murdered, crucified like Jesus. Mohammedans could not understand him. This happens always. You cannot understand any higher point than your own. It becomes a danger to you. If you accept it, then you accept that there is some possibility which is higher than you. That hurts the ego. That humiliates. You would like to destroy a Mansur or a Christ or a Socrates just for a single reason, that you cannot conceive, you cannot concede that there is a possibility of some higher standpoint than you. You seem to believe that you are the last thing in existence, that you are the paradigm, that you are the climax, that there is no beyond. This is the attitude of the stupid and the irreligious mind. The religious mind is always open. The religious mind is never confined by its own limitations. It keeps remembering that there is no end to growth. One can go on growing. It is said in the Bible, God created man in His own image. This is a human statement. It says nothing about God. It simply says something about man. It is man writing about himself. Naturally, man thinks in terms which are anthropomorphic. Man thinks in terms as if man is the center of existence. God created man in His own image. He has to create. At least in human scriptures, He has to follow the human mind and the human ego. Just the contrary is the case. Man has created God in his own image. Man's God is a human God. You can see, you can go in the temples and you can see the images of God. They are made in the form of human beings. A little better. More beautiful. But still, a modification, a decoration of the human body, human eyes, with a little more compassion. Just a little more is added. The ideal human being, that's what our gods are. When Nietzsche declared that God is dead, in fact he was not saying anything against God himself. He was simply saying the God that we have followed up to now is no more applicable because man has grown. The God that we have been following up to now was a childish, juvenile God. Because humanity was juvenile. Somebody worshipping a stone as God, he is saying a very, very primitive. His statement is very primitive. Pagan. Somebody is worshipping an idol. A little better. But still limited. All forms are limited. Somebody is worshipping a tree. A little more alive. Because the tree has a kind of vitality. God is vital. The tree participates in God, that's why it is vital. God is green and fresh, and so is the tree. And God blooms, and the tree blooms. There is at one moment. But a tree is a tree. Maybe a far away reflection of the divine. But to worship the tree as God is ignorant. Somebody is worshipping a river, maybe right, in his own way. Because the river also expresses the divine. Everything expresses him. But everything expresses in a limited way. He is all. So no single thing can express him in his totality. How a single thing can express him in his totality? If you worship the tree, what about the river? If you worship the river, what about the sun? If you worship the sun, what about the moon? You can worship only one thing. And just because it is limited and one, it cannot represent all. When Nietzsche said, God is dead, he was saying that all formulations of God up to now have become irrelevant. Man has gone beyond them. Man has become more mature. Man needs new gods every time. As man becomes more mature, he needs a more mature God. Look in the Old Testament. God is ferocious. Very jealous. God declares that I am a very jealous God. If you worship somebody else, I will be your enemy. I will torture you in hell. I will throw you in fire. Seems to be a very primitive God. Seems to be conceived by Genghis Khan. Not very cultured, not very sophisticated yet. The Hindu God is far more sophisticated. Krishna with his flute is far more cultured. But Buddha reaches to the very peak because he drops the idea of God. He talks about godliness. The very word God makes God like a thing. Defined, clear-cut, solid, concrete, like a rock. Buddha drops the very idea. He says there is godliness, but there is no God. There is divineness. Existence is full with divineness. Bhagavata. But there is no God like a person sitting there on a golden throne, controlling, managing, creating. No, there is no God as a person. The whole existence is full of divinity. That is true. It is overflowing with godliness. Now, this is a far higher conception. We drop the limitation of a person. we make God more like a process. The ancient concept says God created the world, He is the creator. Buddha will not agree to it. He says, God is creativity, not creator. God is one with His creativity. So whenever you are creating something, you participate in God. When a painter is last painting, he is completely absorbed in his painting. He is no more an ordinary painter. He is divine. In that moment of absorption, then union, then fusion. A dancer, lost utterly in his dance, is no more human. Hence the beauty. Hence the utter beauty. Even those who are just spectators, even they start feeling something strange, incredible, fantastic happening. It happened that when Al-Hillaz Mansur was going to be crucified, for 9 years he was confined in a jail. And he was tremendously happy because he used those 9 years for constant meditation. Outside, there were always disturbances, distractions, friends, followers, the society, the world, the worries. He was very happy the day he was put into jail. He thanked God from his very heart. And he said, you love me so much. Now you have given me complete protection from the world. And there is nothing left except you and me. Then the union, then the fusion. Those 9 years were of tremendous absorption. When after 9 years, it was decided that he has to be crucified. Because he has not changed a bit. On the contrary, he has gone farther into the same direction. His direction was this, that he started declaring that I am God, I am al-Haq, I am the truth, I am the reality. His masters, Al-Junaid, persuaded him, tried in many ways, that don't say these things. Keep them inside you. Because the people won't understand it. And you will be unnecessarily getting in trouble. But it was beyond Mansur. Whenever he will be in that state, what Sufis call hal, whenever he will be in that state, he will start singing and dancing. And those utterances will simply overflow. It was not possible for him to control. There was nobody to control. All control was lost. Junaid understood his state. But he knew the state of the people too. That sooner or later, he will be thought to be anti-religious. His declaration that I am God is a fact. His experience is there behind it. But people don't understand that. They will take it as arrogance, as ego. And there will be trouble. And the trouble came. After 9 years, they decided that he has not changed a bit. In fact, he has grown deeper into it. Now he continuously is declaring, Analhaq, I am the truth, I am God. So finally they decided that he has to be crucified. The day they went to take him out from his prison cell, it was very difficult to take him out. because he was in a hall, in that mystic state. He was no more a person. He was just pure energy. How to drag pure energy out? The people who had gone there were just struck dumb. It was so fantastic what was happening in that dark cell. It was so luminous. Mansoor was surrounded by an aura, not of this world. Mansoor was not there as a person. Sufis has two words for it. One is baka, another is fana. Baka means when you are defined by a personality, when you have a definition around you, a demarcation line, that this is you. Fana means when you are dissolved into God and you don't have any definition. Baka is like an ice cube, and fana is like the ice cube has melted and become one with the river. This constantly happens to the mystics. They move from baka to fana, from fana to baka. It is like almost like day and night. By and by there comes a kind of rhythm. Sometimes you will find the mystic in the state of baka, and when you will find him in the state of baka, you will see unique individuality that has ever been seen. In the state of baka, he will be an unique individual, very original, very pure, clear cut. He will be like a peak standing against the sky, or like a star in the dark night, so clear, so separate, so individual. That is the meaning of baka, individuals. You will not find that kind of individuals in the ordinary world. There are people but not individuals. Persons but not individuals. A person is one who has no individuality but just an anonymous part of a mass. He lives like they live. He talks like they talk. He eats like they eat. He goes to the movie where they go. He purchases the car that they purchase. He makes the house like they make. He is continuously following they, the mass, the collectivity, the crowd. He is not himself. He is very confused. His boundary lines are very messy. They are there, but in a mess. They are not clear cut. If you look into him, you will not find him there. You will find layers upon layers of conditioning. He will be a Mohammedan because he was born in a Mohammedan house. He will be a Hindu because he was born into a Hindu family. He will be reciting Gita because his father used to recite, and father's father, and for ages they have been reciting. So he is reciting. It seems all accidental. He has no uniqueness in him. He is just part. He lives like they live, he dies like they die. He lives their life, he dies their death. He never asserts. He is never rebellious. This is the state of ordinary personality. This is not individuality. Individuality arises only when you become very clear cut, when you attain an original shape of your being, when you do your thing. when you don't care what others say, when you are ready to sacrifice your whole life for your freedom, when freedom becomes your ultimate value, nothing else matters, then you become baka, individual. And this is the paradox, that only individuals can go into fana, into that utter desolation, into that utter disappearance. First you have to be, only then you can disappear. If you are not, then what is going to disappear? First you have to detach yourself from the crowd. Only then you can take the jump. So this is the paradox. The man of the state of baka can go into the state of fana. And only he can go. The mass man cannot go into fana because he does not know who he is. He has no address yet. He has no name yet. He has no identity yet. He is just a number. He can be replaced very easily. He is replaceable. He is just a part doing a certain kind of work. He is a function. For example, he may be an engineer. If he dies, you can put another engineer there and nobody will miss him. Or he may be a doctor. If he dies, you replace another doctor there and nobody will miss him. He is a replaceable part. He is a function. But the man of baka is not a function. He has a totally different kind of quality in his being. He will be missed forever and ever. Once he is gone, you cannot replace him. You cannot replace Jesus. You can replace the Pope of the Vatican. Many times you have replaced. Each time one Pope dies, another. You can replace the Shankaracharya of Puri very easily. There is no problem. One dies, you put another. But you cannot replace the original Shankaracharya. You cannot replace Jesus. You cannot replace Muhammad. Once gone, they are gone forever. They exist as unique individuals. That is the state of baka. And they are only capable people who can go into fana. It looks contradictory. Because fana means losing all your definition. Losing all your being. But first, you have to have the being to lose it. How can you lose it if you don't have it? How can you renounce it if you don't have it? So the paradox is only apparent. It has a very, very universal law behind it. First you have to have it to drop it. First gather together. It is the gathering together. Then the silence. First gather together. Integrate. Become baka. And then you can go into a fana. This man Mansur became a man of unique individuality. Wherever he went, he was immediately recognized. It was impossible to miss him. He had come to India too. In fact, because his master Al-Junaid has told him that it is better if you start traveling into other countries, otherwise you will be caught. That's why he traveled far away countries. Everywhere he was recognized immediately. He was a king of kings. You cannot miss him. If he is standing in 10,000 people's crowd, you will be able to see him. He has baka. He is crystal clear. His presence is immense, huge, enormous. Once you have seen him, all other persons will look pale, faint, flat. So sooner or later he will be recognized and he will have to leave the country because the trouble will arise. He had gone to many countries in the Middle East, but wherever he went, few days it was okay. He could live without being recognized. But how long? Not for long. Then finally he went back and said to Junaid, his master, that it is futile. I get caught everywhere. So why not here? When this man was being carried from the cell, the officers who had come to take him out could not exactly find where he is. He was there, utterly there. The whole cell was full of a radiance, a presence, very solid, yet indefinable. They could not enter into the cell. They stood there in awe, in wonder what to do. Finally, they gathered courage. They tried to pull him, but they cannot. They could not. Then there was only one way. His master, Al-Junaid, was asked to come and help, because the time is passing and he has to be crucified and we cannot take him out. Came Al-Junaid and he said, Mansur, now listen. 1,001 times I have told you that surrender to God. If he wants you to be crucified, then be ordinary and be crucified. Let him do his work. Enough is enough. And when Al-Junaid shouted, Mansur came back out of the funnel into the bakar. Again, there was demarcation line. He was no more a cloud. He became concrete and solid. The boundaries appeared. The master has come and he has to listen to his master. Then he was taken to the gallows. It was very difficult to kill him. 1,000 wounds were made on his body. Then too he was alive. Then they started cutting his limbs. Then too he was alive. Because on the cross, again, he lost the estate of Baqa and came into the estate of Fana. Got lost again into ecstasy, into that energy that is God. God is energy for a man of the status of Mansur. God is consciousness for the estate of the man Buddha. God is love for Christ. He is not a person. These three L's have to be learned. God is love, life, light. You have heard about three R's. Three R's make you civilized. These three L's make you religious. Be moralized, so much so that you become one with life. Then let love arise, so much so that you start overflowing with love. You know no boundaries then. Then out of you starts arising, a new kind of light, a luminousness. These three L's have to be learned, and those three R's have to be forgotten. The whole philosophy of Sufism is to approach God as cosmic energy with no concept. But we all have concepts, and all concepts are juvenile, childish. God cannot be conceptualized. We have been given concepts by others. We have learned them. They are just suggestions from the mass. Ideas put into your head. Christians have an idea of an old man with a white beard, very ancient looking, sitting there on a golden throne, surrounded by angels, controlling the world. Nothing wrong about it, but nothing right either. Good to satisfy the curiosity of small children. Children also need some idea about God. But one has to grow out of this childishness. We go on hammering certain ideas into the heads of small children. I have heard the clergyman said to Mistress Mott, whose baby was just christened, "Ah, Mistress Mott, I have never seen a child that was so well behaved at a christening." Mistress Mott, "Well, it is because my husband and I have been practicing on him with a watering can for a week." If you practice on a child for 1 week with a watering can, of course, it becomes habitual. And that's what has been done to humanity down the ages. Ideas have been practiced on you. Those who practice them don't know what they are doing. They are in the same trap. Their parents had practiced those ideas on them. They don't know what they are talking about. What exactly the word God means, if you insist too much, you will make anybody and everybody uncomfortable. So, asking questions is not supported. One has to accept these things. One has to believe these things. Nobody likes asking. If you ask too much, if you go on asking, you make the other person very uncomfortable. Because you start seeing and touching his buttons, it is also a belief for him. He does not know what God is. It is just out of fear that children have been trained. And out of fear they go on clinging. That's why whenever you are afraid, you start thinking of God more. In a dark night, passing through a cemetery, you are bound to remember God. When you are alone, ill, in difficulties, in frustration, in anxieties, in misery, you remember God. God is more concerned as if with being miserable. If you are happy, you tend to forget God. God has no association with happiness. In reality, it should be just otherwise. When you are happy, you can approach God more easily, because a happy mind is a flowing mind. A happy mind is an open mind. A happy mind is more vulnerable, more delicate. An unhappy mind is closed. A mind who lives in fear, how it can be open? It is not possible. I have heard a young man wanted to pass an old man in a wagon on a country road, but the old man would not pull over. Finally, when he had passed the old man, he took his pistol out and walked back to the wagon. "Old man, do you know how to dance?" he asked, shooting at the ground near his feet and laughing uproariously as the old man began to jump up and down. The young man started back when the old man grabbed his concealed shotgun and said, "Young man, did you ever kiss a mule?" The young man said, looking into the barrel of the shotgun, "No, but I always wanted to." Out of fear you can create anything. And your God is created out of fear. Your God is nothing but your fear instinct. It is not your experience. A little boy in Aberdeen, Scotland, was disciplined by his mother, who used to say to him, when he was naughty, "Now, God won't like that." And when he was particularly unruly or disobedient, she would say, "God will be angry." Usually these admonitions were sufficient. But one night, when she had prunes for his dessert at supper, he rebelled. He refused to finish the prunes on his plate. She pleaded. She coaxed. Finally said, "Now, God won't like this. God does not like little boys who refuse to finish all their prunes." But the little fellow was quite unmoved. She went further to say, "God will be angry." But for some reason or other, the little boy stubbornly refused to take the last two prunes which lay on his plate, dark blue, wrinkled, tokens of his rebellion. "Well," said the mother, "you must now go to bed. You have been a very naughty boy and God is angry, real angry." So she packed him upstairs and put him to bed. No sooner had she come down then a violent thunderstorm broke out. The lightning was more vivid than usual. The thunder clumped up and down the sky with shattering reverberations. The suddenly angry wind threw handfuls of rain against the windows. It was a most violent storm, and she thought her little son would be terrified, and that she would go up and comfort him. Quietly, she opened his bedroom door, expecting to find him whimpering in fear, perhaps with the covers pulled over his head, but to her surprise he was not in bed at all, but he had gone to the window. With his face pressed against the window pane, she heard him mutter, my, such a fuss to make over two prunes." But that's how your God is. You have been brought up in fear. And you have been brought up in greed. Because of fear and greed, you go on believing in a certain idea of God. That idea is as absurd as your greed and your fear. It has nothing to do with God. It has something to do with you and your psychology. If you really want to know what God is, then you will have to drop all kinds of fear and all kinds of greed. You will have to drop, in reality, your whole psychology, your whole mind. God is an experience of the state of no mind. fana. When you are no more dissolved, then you know what God is. So few things. God is not a concept, theory, hypothesis, explanation, philosophy. Not at all. How can you make a concept of something that you don't know? You don't know God. You have never encountered God. So whatsoever you think about Him is borrowed. It is pseudo. The real has to be your experience. It may be a kind of explanation, because there are problems in life, and there are puzzles in life, and there are mysteries in life, and you always find difficulty how to explain them. Birth is there, and death is there, and this whole tremendously beautiful existence is there, from where it comes, who creates it, why it is at all. Why it is rather than not. 1001 questions arise in the mind, and you need some comfortable, convenient explanation so you can rest and sleep well. God is a blanket explanation. It covers all your problems. In a single concept, you explain everything. Whenever you say, God knows, you simply mean, I don't know. But a very tricky strategy. You don't say, I don't know. You say, God knows. It gives you a kind of feeling that you may not know it, but there is somebody who knows. And that is your God. And He takes care. You need not worry. Father knows, mother knows, God knows, somebody knows. So why bother? You can remain unburdened. But let me tell you, God is not an explanation. And those who cling to explanations will never know what God is. God is the dropping away of all explanations and all theories and all philosophies. God is the dropping away of all kinds of thinking. Because thinking is a barrier. How can you think about the unknown? You can think only about the known. Thinking is just chewing the same thing again and again. You can think only that which you have known already. Thinking never gives you anything original. It cannot give. It is not in its nature. And God is the most unknown phenomenon. God means the totality. It is not known. All explanations are kind of deceptions. Deceiving yourself, deceiving others that you know. A sincere, honest seeker will drop all explanations. That is the meaning when Al-Hillah says, it is the gathering together, then the silence. The silence which comes when you drop all explanations, all theories, all philosophies. Then the loss of words. Then the words are not needed at all. When all theories and all explanations and philosophies have been dropped, what you are going to do with words? Then the loss of words and the awareness. And when words are lost, in that silence arises awareness. Then the discovering and the nakedness. you are utterly naked. Before God, you have to be utterly naked. No explanations. No philosophy surrounding you. You have to be as naked as possible. Totally nude. Empty. Undressed. Then only there is a possibility to contact God. God is not a person, second thing to remember. It is human to think about God as a person. When we think about God as a person, it looks warmer. Lao Tzu says Tao, but Tao doesn't seem so warm. You cannot hug Tao. Tao cannot hug you. Buddha says Dhamma, the La, but the La seems to be cold. You need some warm embrace. You need a God who can love you, who can caress you, who can kiss you, who can take you close, who can hold your hand. This is human desire. Desire for warmth. But existence has no obligation to fulfill your desires. Your desire is all right, but your desire simply shows that you are missing love, not God. Try to understand it. Your desire simply shows that you have missed your parents, your mother, your father. You have missed a beloved. Your desire simply shows that there is some hankering for love that you are projecting on God. So God becomes a person. You transform God into a person because of your needs. But this is your needs. And there is no necessity that your need has to be fulfilled. You have to understand your need and drop it. That's why my insistence is, never remain unfulfilled in your love, otherwise you will never find the real God. Love as much as you can. Love human beings, love animals, love trees, love rocks, mountains, rivers, love as much as you can. Let there be great experience of love, so your love need is fulfilled, so that one day you can transcend love. Just the other day, there was a question from Anand Prem. Why, she asked, spiritual persons want to go beyond love? This is why. Because if you are not yet satisfied in your love, you will go on projecting love needs on God. And that will be a false God. That will be your projection. That will be your idea, not the reality of God. You cannot see the reality of God. You will see God in terms you would like Him to be. You cannot see that which is. You will have a kind of wish fulfillment. So Freud is not absolutely wrong when he says that God is a kind of wish fulfillment. He is right about 99% people. He is right about Anand Prem. Anand Prem is suffering from a love need. She tries to find a lover and she cannot. Because she has a certain idea of a lover. The very idea becomes an obstruction. She searches for a perfect lover. Yes, it is very difficult in the first place to find a perfect lover. And if you can find, the perfect lover will not be in any kind of need. A needy person cannot relate to a perfect lover. Only a perfect lover can relate to a perfect lover. Both will be without needs. Their love will be of a totally new kind. It will be a kind of sharing. Not that they need each other, but just because they have so much, so they want to give it. A perfect lover is one who is as happy alone as when he is with the beloved. There is no difference. Then he is a perfect lover. But he is as happy alone. Now Anand Prem goes on searching for a perfect lover. And because he cannot find the perfect lover, and ordinary human beings are just worthless for her, now she can start projecting upon God. She writes in her question that what about Meera? Meera loved God in the form of Krishna. Is this she attained? Yes, she loved God in the form of Krishna. But Meera's love is the love of a perfect human being. She has no need. She does not want anything from Krishna. She simply goes on giving. She has a song to sing. She sings. She has a dance to dance. She dances. She has nothing to get. She only gives. And she gets thousandfold. That is another thing. But she has nothing to get. If Anand Prem wants to become Meera, first she will have to fulfill about human love needs. Otherwise your Krishna will be false. It will not be Meera's Krishna. Your Krishna will be just your imagination. Your Krishna will be just a projection of a repressed desire. Your Krishna will have much sexuality. First be finished with the human needs. And the only way to be finished is to go into them. I am not against them, remember. And I am not saying that something is wrong in them. There is a great lesson in them, and that can be learned only by going through them. Go through them. Don't demand impossible. Otherwise, love will not happen. Remember the limitation of human beings. And remember your limitations. And whatsoever kind of love is possible, go into it. Don't hanker for the impossible. Otherwise, you will miss even the possible. An impossible cannot happen. The impossible happens only the other way round. You go through the possible, let the possible be finished. Let your being come out of it fulfilled. Then the impossible can also happen. You have become capable of it. If people's love needs are not fulfilled, they go on projecting on God, and poor God suffers unnecessarily. When I was reading Anand Prem's question, I became very, very sad for God. If Anand Prem starts loving God, then think about God too. Because he cannot go to the course, and because he cannot say no, just he has to suffer your love. First, go through human turmoils, human anguish, the joys of human love and the miseries of human love. Let yourself become ripe through it. Then only you have the fragrance which can be offered to God, not before it. First become a lotus. Come out of the mud of desire. And remember, the lotus comes out of the mud. out of desiring comes the state of desirelessness, the lotus of desirelessness. Seeing the futility of desire again and again and again, one day, one becomes so mature that one drops the very desire. In that very dropping is the meeting. When there is no desire, there is nothing to hinder you from seeing God. Then God is all over the place. Then God only is. But God is not a person. Christians say God is a father. God is not a father. That simply shows somehow your father need is still unfulfilled. There are people who say God is a mother. That simply shows their mother need is unfulfilled. There are some who think God is the lover, then their love need is not fulfilled. What you say about God shows something about you. If you think of God as Father, that simply shows that you are unsatisfied with your Father. That you are not yet reconciled with your Father. That you have become too much dependent on your Father. You need a father in the sky now. Maybe your father is dead and you cannot live without a father. Or maybe your father is far away and you cannot live without your father. You are still immature and childish. You need somebody to cling to. Then you will create God the Father. God is neither father, nor mother, nor lover, nor beloved. God is not a person at all. God is energy, cosmic energy. God is continuous creativity. God is love, life, light. God is not an object of experience either. It is not that one day you will encounter God as an experience of object. God is not an object and God is not a subject either. When subject and object meet and disappear into each other, fana, then there is a new kind of experience. What Krishnamurti calls experiencing. Not even experience. Because the very word experience seems to be finished, complete, rounded. God is never complete, never finished. It is always an ongoing affair. Always open, always flowering, always moving. God is a dynamic energy. God is process, not a thing. So, an experiencing. And what is an experiencing? And what is the difference between experience and experiencing? The difference is, in experience you remain separate from the object. For example, you are listening to me. Now this can happen in two ways. Those who are just here as spectators, as listeners, as audience, for them it is an experience. I am here separate from them, they are separate from me. I am an object and they are the subject. They are there, centered in their ego, listening to me. And continuously judging whether this is right or wrong, whether this applies or not, whether this can be practiced or not, whether this agrees with our scripture or not. Continuously judging inside. This will be an experience. but those who are in deep love with me, who are not standing against me, who are not there as subjects, listening to me, who get lost into it, enwrapped with me, involved with me, as if they are listening to themselves, to their own heart beat, then there is not experience, but experiencing. Then I am not here separate from them, and they are not there separate from me. Then there is a union and a fusion. God is an experiencing. If you want to know what God is, you will have to learn the art of experiencing. Then there is no need to go to a mosque or to a temple or to a church. Wherever experiencing happens, there is the church, there is the temple, there is the mosque. Looking at a rose flower, if you disappear into the rose flower and the rose flower disappears into you, the observer becomes the observed, and there is no distinction left. There are not two things confronting each other, but meeting, merging, melting into each other. Boundaries are no more there. Somehow you have entered into the rose, and the rose has entered in you. And this is possible. This transfiguration is possible. Because it is possible, religion is relevant, meaningful. Otherwise, religion won't be meaningful. Then, being with the rose flower, you entered into God. Then all possibilities can be used as doors to the divine. I have heard Bernard Shannon writes, think of a man driving up a country hill road, who upon reaching the top, stops his car and walks over to a nearby five-barred gate, leaning on it. Then while he gazes with pleasure at the vista spread out before him, there is a sky of breathless blue, full of birds wheeling lazily in the warm sun. Fields of emerald green ripple in the soft breeze, while on the hillsides cattle and sheep graze peacefully. The whole scene is one of tranquil beauty, and the man draws a deep breath, saying, "It is really lovely." At that moment, another car draws up, and the first man is joined by another. "Beautiful, is not it?" murmurs the first man. The other man is silent for a moment, then says thoughtfully, "Have you ever considered what is really happening out there? These graceful birds who wheel in the sky are seeking food. How graceful do they look to the insects they gobble, or to the writhing worms they drag from the earth with cruel and rending beaks?" The first man sits uneasily, "Come now." The other man speaks again, "Those sheep so peacefully grazing, they are being fattened and will soon be dragged to the slaughterhouse. Trembling with fear as they smell the blood-stained floor on which they will die, their little lambs will be snatched away to dangle from butcher's hooks." The first man is silent as the voice continues, "This emerald green grass, rippling in the sun, within it murder and mayhem are constantly taking place, as the spiders devour flies and large insects devour the smaller. If the sounds could be interpreted and magnified, screams of pain and fear would reverberate throughout this lush meadow." The first is a poet, looks through the eyes of positivity, The second is a critic, looks through the eyes of negativity. Bernard Shannon ends this small parable here. I would like to bring another man, the mystic, in. A third car comes. Gets out a mystic who listens to the stories of both the man and laughs. And he says, life is not either or. Life is both ends. You both are right. But life is more than that. Yes, there is dark night and there is bright day. There is summer and there is winter, and there is life and there is death. You both are right. But you have chosen one standpoint against the other. You see only at the half picture of life. Because of that half, and you try to impose as if that half is the whole, you go wrong. I don't choose. I simply accept the as it is. Yes, there is death and there is life, and both are intertwined. Seeing the both together, one transcends. One transcends to a higher peak. Then one is no more dominated by any standpoint. Then you see life and death as part of each other. And then you are so transcendental to both that you see eternity. Then there is neither beauty nor ugliness. There is simply truth. Beauty is choosing one standpoint. Ugliness is choosing another standpoint. Truth is not choosing any standpoint at all. Not choosing is truth. God is not any aspect of reality. God is all the aspects together without any choice. If you choose, you miss. If you don't choose, there is no way to miss. But there is a problem. When you choose, you can remain yourself. All choice feeds the ego. When you don't choose, you disappear. You disappear with your choice, likes, dislikes. You cannot exist without choosing. The ego cannot exist without choice. Choice is its very breath. Just as you cannot exist if the breath disappears. Ego cannot exist without choosing, without taking standpoints, without being for and against. Once you don't take any standpoint, you disappear. In that disappearance is God. You will never meet God, remember. Nobody has ever met God. When we say that they have met God, what is meant is that they have disappeared. Only God is. The ego disappears, and then there is experiencing. Continuous. Constant. Eternal. That energy, that ever-flowing energy is what God is. So remember, God is not an object of experience, and neither the subject of an experience, but God is experiencing itself. God is not static, but process, evolving, expanding, exploding, exploring. It goes on and on. It is an adventure. It is a pilgrimage from nowhere to nowhere. God is not there in the heavens or somewhere else. God is not there. God is here. And God is not then. God is now. And God is not that. God is this. If you can understand these few words, here, now, this, these three words are the three pillars of Sufism, of Zen too, of all that is essential religion. These three words, let them vibrate into your being again and again. Here, now, this. Those who think of God as that, far away somewhere else, are just imagining and missing the obvious, which is just close by. God is not far away. He is closer than you are to yourself. He is your innermost core. How he can be far away? And God is not then, in the past, in the future. It is not that God used to walk in the days of Moses and talk to people. It is not that God used to talk to Muhammad and will not talk to you. It is not that he used to sing songs to the seers of the Upanishads and he has forgotten you or abandoned you. God is now. God is always now. God is never past, never future. In relationship to God, past and future are meaningless words. You cannot say God was. You cannot say God will be. You have always to say God is. There is only one tense, is. Present. And God is here. This very moment. If you can be in a state of experiencing, God is here. Now, this, if you cannot be in the state of experiencing that God is never, nowhere, this state of experiencing is what Sufis call meditation. But this God here, now, this, is a dangerous God. You have to disappear for it to be. You have to dissolve into it. It is risky. We have created substitutes to avoid the risk. It was announced in church one day that a substitute preacher would preach. A little boy leaned over and asked his mother, "What is a substitute?" "Well, for example, son, if you threw your baseball through the window and broke it, and we did not have another real pain, we could put a piece of cardboard in the window. That is what we call a substitute." When the substitute minister had finished preaching, That morning, the little boy leaned over and said, "Mother, this sure is not a substitute. He is a real pain." Your all substitutes are real pain. Because no substitute can ever satisfy. No substitute can ever fulfill. No substitute can ever quench your thirst. But man is very cunning and goes on creating substitutes. Your temples are substitute temples. Your teachers are substitute teachers. Your prayers are substitute prayers. Your own prayer has not arisen yet. And you have not yet found the temple of experiencing. But remember, you choose these substitutes and then you suffer. And when you suffer, you blame God. I have heard Cohen, aged 86, had lived through beatings in police pogroms, concentration camps in Germany, and dozens of other anti-Semitic calamities. Ah Lord, he prayed sitting in the synagogue, "Is not it true that we are your chosen peoples?" And from the heavens boomed a voice, "Yes, Cohen, the Jews are my chosen peoples." "Well, then," wailed the old man, "is not it time you choose somebody else?" Nobody is God's chosen people. You have chosen it to be God's chosen people. And then you suffer. Jews have suffered really long. And all their misery can be condensed to this single thing. They have chosen to be the chosen people of God. And that very ego has created great antagonism. And they are stubbornly clinging to it. The more they have suffered, the more they have become stubborn. But God has not chosen anybody. How God can choose? All is His. All is He. There is no question of choice. But we choose our ideas. And then those ideas become prisons, calamities. Beware. If you are suffering, then look back. You must have chosen something wrong. Otherwise you cannot suffer. This is my basic observation of observing thousands of people and their miseries. Whenever I see somebody suffering and in misery, by and by I have become absolutely certain about one thing, that he is responsible. That he has chosen some wrong ideas. That he has chosen some wrong notions. Although those who suffer, they always throw their responsibility on others. And sometimes it seems very unjust. If two persons come to me, a couple comes to me, and the wife is miserable, or the husband is miserable, and the other partner is not miserable at all. And the miserable partner tries to throw the responsibility on the other. That he is responsible for my misery. It seems very hard to tell the person who is in misery that you must be responsible for your misery because nobody else can be responsible for your misery. And the other is happy. He must have chosen different values. He must have chosen values that give happiness, health, wholeness. You have chosen wrong values and you suffer. But you can always manipulate and interpret in such a way that your suffering seems as if it has been done to you. Nobody can make you suffer. It is always basically you who decide whether to suffer or not. In every situation, you can take such a standpoint that you can get out of suffering. And in every situation, you can take such an standpoint that you can create as much suffering as you like. But people like to suffer. There is a reason in it. The more they suffer, the more they are. In suffering, the ego feels strengthened. In bliss, it disappears. So you go on saying that we need bliss, that we seek bliss. But when I look into you, I find just the other thing. You seek misery. You live on misery. You look for misery. You go on saying that I seek bliss and you go on looking for misery. Unless this mechanism is understood perfectly well, you will never be able to know what God is. God is bliss. And bliss is possible only when you have understood the phenomenon, how you create your misery. Substitutes create misery. For example, you wanted to love a woman, but love was dangerous, unsocial, rebellious, or who knows what will happen. And you settled for a marriage. Now the marriage is a substitute of love. You will never be happy. You will be miserable. Of course, you will be comfortably miserable, conveniently miserable, but miserable all the same. You will have a certain security, a good bank balance, prestige, respect, but you will not be happy. Look at your respectable people. They have all that they always thought will help them. They have it. Money they have, power they have, prestige they have. But look into their eyes, deserts. Not a single flower blooms. No joy. Just dragging themselves somehow. They settled for a substitute. Go and sit by the corner of a temple or a mosque and watch people coming and going. Do you see any celebration? Do you see real joy? Do you see any dance? Nothing. People just walk into the temple as part of their formal duty and get out as soon as they can. They have to fulfill a certain duty. They have to show to the society that they are religious people. It pays. But no joy. Temple is a substitute. See people praying. Not a single tear comes to their eyes. See people praying. No radiance on their faces. Not even a ripple of dance around them. And they go on praying for their whole life. Sheer wastes of time and energy. They have chosen a substitute. Beware of substitutes. Only then you can find God. God has no substitute. God is the really real. Haq, the truth. Now, this is small parables. Imam Muhammad Bakir is said to have related this illustrative fable. finding I could speak the language of ants, I approached one and inquired, "What is God like? Does he resemble the ants?" He answered, "God? No, indeed. We have only a single sting, but God, he has two." That's how your all religions and philosophies are. Just your God is your magnified rule. You have one sting, he has two. You live 70 years, he lives eternally. You become old, he never becomes old. But the difference is of quantity, not of quality. Your God is your projected, reformed, modified, decorated form. Your God is you as you would like to be. Just think how you would like to be. Just write down on a paper how you would like to be, what you would like to be. And you will be surprised when you will end your thesis, you will be surprised this is your idea of God. You would like to live always and always young. You would like to be surrounded by beautiful women. You would like to be living in a golden palace. You would like to sit on a golden throne studded with valuable stones. You would like a beautiful garden, always green, always flowering. You would like a life with no labor, just rest. Then look, what is your idea of God? And you will be surprised, this is your idea of God. That's what he is doing in Firdaus, in paradise. The word paradise comes from a Persian word, Firdaus. Firdaus means a walled garden, a pleasure garden. That's what God is doing in paradise. Angels always singing songs. And all that he needs is there. Immediately his needs are fulfilled. And that's what you hanker someday to enter into paradise and there be contented forever. Your idea of God is nothing but your condensed desire, how you would like to be. Yes, you concede little more to God. Just that much. As the ant said, God, no indeed. We have only a single sting, but God, he has two. Doubles, triples, thousandfolds, does not matter. But your God is just a magnified form of yourself. This is not going to do. You are so miserable that a magnified form of you is going to be a magnified misery, nothing else. You have one sting, he will have two. This parable simply shows that all our concepts of God are anthropocentric. If you ask the donkeys, they will have a God who looks like a donkey. Don't go on buttressing yourself that donkeys will have a God who looks like a man. Never. Donkeys will have a God who looks like a perfect donkey. Horses will have a God who looks like a perfect horse. That will be the last thing for a donkey to think that man is made in the image of God and God is like man. That is impossible. Man has done so much harm to the donkeys and has exploited donkeys so long They cannot believe that God looks like this man who is sitting on top of them. That will be the last thing. That will be the form of devil. We think of God according to our minds. But our minds are the barriers. So God cannot be conceived. Mind has to be dropped. When there is no mind, there is a release of energy. There is experiencing. There is joy. There is ecstasy. Let me repeat. What is God? Al-Hillaz Mansur says, it is the gathering together, then the silence, then the loss of words and the awareness, then the discovering and the nakedness, and it is the fire play. Then the fire, then the clarity and the cold, then the darkness, then the sun, and it is the argy, then the casting away of cares, then the wish and the approach, then the conjunction, then the joy, and it is the strain, then the relaxation, then the disappearance and the separation. Then the union, then the fusion. Enough for today.